All right, let's go ahead and get started. If you would, please turn in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 20. We'll be starting in Genesis chapter 20 tonight in just a few moments. If you look at the schedule, this is we're on lesson 16. We'll have tonight, we'll try and get through Genesis chapter 20 through about 22. And then for Sunday, we'll finish up through chapter 25 and verse 11, which is going to finish our study on Abraham. And then we'll move into Jacob. So what's missing? If we go from Abraham to Jacob, we've kind of not mentioned Isaac, who's kind of right there in the middle. And so if you're noticing very carefully on the lesson, there's no Isaac lessons. But Isaac is actually going to be covered tonight and Sunday in the discussions of Abraham, in so much as Isaac interacts with Abraham and then with his sons, Jacob and Esau. So we actually will cover Isaac. He's just not on the agenda. All right, so if we're in chapter 20, before we get started, I've asked Roy to lead our minds in a word of prayer. So, tonight, starting in chapter 20, we're here on the timeline in this period of the patriarchs, squarely in the midst of that, moving forward. Tonight, we're going to talk about a story where Abraham says, "She is my sister." Any of this sound familiar? A little deja vu here? In fact, in Genesis, there are three such stories as this, two involving Abraham, and then one involving Isaac. And in each case, they're true. Sarah is Abraham's sister, and Rebekah is Isaac's sister, as we'll see. But it's not the whole truth. It's part of the truth. So, in this story, as we look at Genesis chapter 20, we see Abraham journeying there in the Promised Land, and he comes down into the area of Gerar. Now, where is Gerar? Or Gerar? Anybody know where that is? What region is that? Who are the peoples that he's among here? This is the Philistines. Okay? So, he's traveled down to Gerar, and again, he's given this story that Sarah is his sister. And so, Abimelech, the king of Gerar, takes her, sends, and has her brought to him. And that night in a dream, he receives a very stern rebuke from God. God says, "You're a dead man." If we look at, "Indeed, you are a dead man because of the woman whom you have taken, for she is a man's wife." But Abimelech had not come near her, and he said, "Lord, will you slay a righteous nation also? Do not say to me, 'She is my sister.' She even herself said, 'He is my brother.' In the integrity of my heart and the innocence of my hands, I've done this." So what do you think? Is Abimelech innocent? It's an interesting question, because he certainly protests innocent, at least with respect to Sarah, right? Now, you might note he doesn't make any apologies for having multiple wives or concubines or any of these other practices that were common back then. Kind of set that aside for a moment. With respect to Sarah, though, he says, "I haven't done anything wrong. She's, as far as he knew, an available woman to bring into his harem." So he protests this, and in fact, his protest is valid. And God says, "Yes, I know you did this in the integrity of your heart, for I also withheld you from sinning against me. Therefore, I did not let you touch her. Now, therefore, restore the man's wife, for he's a prophet, and he will pray for you, and you shall live. So, Abimelech, in this case, now protests to God in this vision. God says, yeah, you were prevented from sinning. And now he goes back and he asks Abraham, okay, why? Why did you do this? What was Abraham's response? What's that? He was afraid. That's right. I was afraid that there was no fear of God here and you might kill me, which is the same reason that he gave when he went to Egypt, right? But if you notice here, he gives two other reasons. So he actually gives a fuller explanation to Abimelech than he gave to Pharaoh. He said, first of all, I was afraid there was no fear of God in this place and you would kill me. Secondly, she really is my sister. So it really wasn't a lie, sort of, kind of. In that Sarah is his half-sister, the daughter of a common father, but not a common mother. And thirdly, this had kind of been their practice, now we see revealed here in chapter 20. If you look at chapter 20 and verse 13, Abraham, in explaining this to Abimelech, says, "It came to pass when God caused me to wander from my father's house." He's not complaining. Remember, God called him out of his father's house and he's been wandering and living in tents. He's not really complaining. He's just stating it as a matter of fact. "When God caused me to wander, that I said to her, 'This is your kindness that you should do for me. In every place, wherever we go, say of me, he is my brother.'" So this was a common practice. Maybe it's a wonder that the Bible only records two instances of it, because apparently they had been doing this for some time. Okay? So, God tells him, this man is a prophet. He's going to pray for you. Restore his wife. Abimelech restores Sarah to Abraham. He prays for healing. And then that's good. It's all over. Story's done, right? Some questions. Why do you think Abraham had this agreement with Sarah? She's a beautiful woman. At this point, a beautiful 95-year-old woman. But apparently still beautiful. Abraham's a powerful man. I mean, you know, it was some years ago that he was able to put 400 men under arms, or 350. And now he's grown since then. So he's a fairly powerful man in the area. But does this indicate trust in God or a lack of trust? What do you think? I don't know an answer to this, but it's an interesting question. Why did he feel like he needed to do this, right? But now when you look at what happens here in Gerar with Abimelech, was the result different than in Egypt? What was different between this experience and the experience when he went down to Egypt? If you look back, there's a number of things. First of all, it's Egypt versus Gerar, which is really just kind of on the southwest part of what we would think of as Judah. So he's not that far from home. In the story about Egypt, there was a famine in the land. They had to go somewhere. Here, it doesn't appear like there was any particular crisis that caused them to go there. It's just Abraham is following the commandments of God to wander to and fro in the land and happened to wind up down in Gerar. What other differences do you see? Well, how was the deception discovered? If you look at it in Egypt, it was plague came on the Egyptians. Here, apparently there was a plague in terms of God closing up the wombs, but he's also spoken very directly to Abimelech in a dream and said, "You're a dead man, here's why." Okay, there's no wondering what's going on here. So what's the difference between Abimelech and Pharaoh in terms of how they address this? Well, Pharaoh is outraged. Remember, he says, "Here, take your wife and go." and assigns troops to see him to the border. But what does Abimelech do? Abimelech shows a very different response. And in some ways, it may be that Abimelech fears God, has some respect for the God of Israel. Because you don't see quite the same outrage. You see offense. You know, what have I done to you that causes you to do this to me? Why did you do this? And in fact, when he asks that question, Abraham opens up and gives him a lot more information, doesn't he? Tells him about the deal that he and Sarah had. Okay, he actually interacts with him a bit more. And when all is said and done, does Abimelech tell him, now get out of here and don't come back? Does he say that? Go. Yes. Now, would a prophet mean anything to Pharaoh? Maybe not. There's some indication that maybe Abimelech had a bit of a soft heart or a bit of an understanding of God, because God talked to him in the dream and said, this man's a prophet, so you need to listen to him. But, you know, as Cherry said, then Abimelech said, choose where you want to go. Please stay with us. And in fact, they do. They stay on. They don't leave. They stay on in the land of Gerar for a while. Yeah, so there's some differences in this story. It's not the same story. It's told from a slightly different perspective. Now, later on, if we skip ahead just a little bit to chapter 21 and verse... Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. In what way was Abraham a prophet? Did he give Abimelech some information that he didn't know? Did he give him a prophecy of some sort? Not that we know of. Not that we know of. But he did intercede for Abimelech. He prayed for him, and God healed the wound. So in a sense, the womb opened the wombs of the women of Abimelech's household. Okay. Now, was Abraham actually a prophet? Did he ever speak a word of prophecy? Yeah, we actually saw that a couple of chapters ago when he was talking about what would come out of his descendants. Was Abraham escorted out of the country as in Egypt? No, he wasn't. He was invited to stay. And then let's look over now to chapter 21 and verse 22. Starting in verse 22, it came to pass at that time that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Now therefore swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but that according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me and to the land in which you have dwelt. So Abraham has been there for a while. Abraham said, I will swear. As we read on through this story, we see basically a political agreement. You know, let's agree not to hurt each other. Let's agree to be friendly towards one another. Abraham by this time is powerful enough that Abimelech wants to have an alliance in place with him of some sort, right? And so then Abraham takes the opportunity to talk about some disputes over water rights, mentions a well, and they have a discussion and ultimately results in Abraham then being recognized as the owner of the well. You know, he dug the well, it's his. Abimelech recognizes that. And Abraham sets out these 7 ewe lambs. Why 7 lambs? That's an interesting question. Why 7 lambs? They have the agreement. They've talked about being allies. They've talked about the well. Who dug the well? Let's recognize who dug the well. Abraham gives him some animals, and then he sets these 7 little ewe lambs off to one side. There's a play on words in the Greek, which one of the commentators was talking about. The root word for swearing is the same root word as 7 not Greek, Hebrew. And so the 7 ewe lambs are to remember that they swore an oath. They came together and agreed. And that word translates is like Shabbat, and so the name of that well was Beersheba, which we see very often described later on in New Testament times. But Abraham's well, and he talks with Abimelech. They agree. Things are settled. They have an alliance. Abraham has the well. and he stays there. And we're going to see him dwelling in Beersheba for a while. Okay? Interesting stuff. Not a lot to talk about there, though, right? So let's move on. What's the importance of Isaac? We've been waiting for Isaac. It's been chapter after chapter. We're waiting for Isaac to make an appearance. Abram's been waiting 100 years for Isaac. What's the importance of Isaac? He was the promise. He was the son of the promise. Yeah, the son of the promise. And, you know, we've had these stories about Abraham with Hagar and Ishmael. No, that's not the one. Maybe it'll be this Eliezer, the slave in my house. No, that's not the one. You're going to have a son. You're going to have descendants. It's going to be a son Sarah will bear to you. Okay? Isaac is that son. So, at the appointed time, we see in chapter 21, at the appointed time, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did for Sarah as he had spoken. Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son in his old age at the set time of which God had spoken to him. This wasn't a little cherub found under a bush. This wasn't somebody had Sarah's maid had a son on her behalf. Sarah conceived and bore a child. This is her child, hers and Abraham's, according to the promise. He's the one that all the promises are going to be fulfilled through. And his name, Isaac, means he laughs. He laughs. Why? Why Isaac? Why should they call him that? What a weird name for a kid. He laughs. What do you think? Sarah laughed when she heard about it. And somebody else said, God said it. Yeah, God said, call him Isaac. Yeah, Sarah laughed. Abraham laughed. Remember back in chapter 17, verse 17, Abraham laughed in his heart, and God made no comment. Because we said Abraham's laughter was this laughter of joy. Sarah's laughter was maybe a different kind of comment, or a different kind of laughter. She laughed in her heart, and God felt it necessary to say, why did Sarah laugh? But now Isaac is born, and he's named, he laughs. And notice what Sarah says in verse 7 of 21. Who would have said to Abraham that Sarah would nurse children? Verse 6, Sarah said, God has made me laugh, and all who hear will laugh with me. So this was a joyous occasion when Isaac was born. This is a big deal. This is the promise 100 years in coming. This is Abraham, the wealthy and powerful, now ready to bestow on his son everything that he has. Right? This is Isaac. That's who Isaac is. Imagine the love that those parents have for this child after 100 years. Okay? Sarah's been barren for almost 100 years, and now this child is born. Obviously, this is setting up what happens in the next chapter. But think about the love that this family is going to have, and the joy that he's going to bring to his parents. We also see in this chapter the other son, the son of the bondwoman, Ishmael. And in this chapter, we now start to see a conflict arising between Ishmael and Isaac. Okay, so kids fight, right? It happens. Get over it. May have been what Abraham was thinking about this, but Sarah saw it quite differently, didn't she? Sarah said, no, he's got to go. He has got to go. Cast out the bondwoman and her son. Seems a little harsh. Why? Why did Ishmael have to go? Keep the peace? Okay. He was the firstborn of Abraham, that's right. The first one born. What else? It's written for our instruction. Everything in the Old Testament we know is written for our instruction. It displeased Abraham. Clearly, he didn't want to step into the middle of this. But God corrected him on that and said, no, listen to your wife. So he gave Hagar water, sent her on her way. That's the picture we see here, representation. Hagar leaves. She gets lost, apparently, or wanders or whatever, but she winds up somewhere in the desert, in the wilderness, with no water and no hopes of her future, and she gives up. Should she have? Did Hagar forget something? Right. God had rescued her once before, and what had he told her? That Ishmael would also be a great nation. That's not going to happen if he dies in the wilderness, is it? So she'd kind of forgotten this, and God reminds her, then opens her eyes, and she's able, oh, look, there's a well. And so she gets some water, revives the son. And then we don't see much more of Ishmael. We're going to see a little bit of discussion of his descendants and the fact that God had promised to make a great nation and 12 princes would come from him. We see that happens too. So, what do you think? Why did God command Abraham to heed Sarah in this matter? It really does feel a little bit harsh. That's exactly right. Yep. Let's go over and take a look at this. In Galatians chapter 4, if you turn there, Galatians chapter 4, and starting about verse 21, and he's contrasting Christianity with the law of Moses and the Mosaic law that some were still trying to keep. Tell me, you who desire to be under the law, do you not hear the law? For it is written that Abraham had two sons, the one by a bondwoman, the other by a free woman. But he who was of the bondwoman was born according to the flesh, and he of the free woman through the promise. Which things are symbolic, for these are the two covenants, the one from Mount Sinai, which gives birth to bondage, which is Hagar. For this Hagar is Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children. But the Jerusalem above is free, which is the mother of us all. For it is written, rejoice, O barren, you who do not bear, break forth and shout, you who are not in labor, for the desolate has many more children than she who has a husband. Now we, brethren, as Isaac was, are children of promise. But as he who was born according to the flesh then persecuted him who was born according to the Spirit, even so it is now. Nevertheless, what does the Scripture say? Cast out the bondwoman and her son. For the son of the bondwoman shall not be heir with the son of the free woman. So then, brethren, we are not children of the bondwoman, but of the free. And so Paul uses this whole story to teach the superiority of Christianity over the Mosaic law, and also the need to put away the old law and move into the new law, the better law, the law of freedom. And it's for exactly the same reason. The son of the bondwoman is not going to share in the inheritance with the son of the free woman. And Ishmael was not to share in the same promises that had been given to Abraham through Isaac. Different promises. Ishmael is also going to become a great nation, but now he has to be separated. Okay? Thoughts or questions on that? It didn't feel like the right thing to do. And yet, God directly told him, heed the voice of your wife in this. How asked this question before. How deep was the love of Abraham and Sarah for Isaac, and why? It would have to be. It would have to be with all of this. Okay. So, it makes it a bit difficult then to understand in chapter 22. Well, come to that in a minute. Chapter 22, what comes next? One last question. Did Isaac and Ishmael ever unite again? Yes? Yeah. 25 and verse 9, they came together when Abraham died to bury him. Excuse me. So now coming back to this chart we looked at before, under Abraham you can see here's Isaac, the son of the promise. Here's Ishmael and the 12 sons that would be born to him. Okay. So now let's move on into chapter 23. We're going to talk about what maybe is the climax of this whole story we've been talking about with Abraham. We talk about Abraham as being a man of faith. He left his home. He left his father's house. He left his people, and he moved to the land of Canaan. Wandered in a land that was promised to him, but that he would never really see. Living in tents all of his life. And he was a man of faith. All of these things demonstrated faith, but maybe nothing more than the sacrifice of his own son. And I want to talk about this sacrifice a little bit, because at the end of the day, when you look at this, did Abraham actually sacrifice his son? No? Okay. What's that? Yeah? Got a yes, got a no. Okay, had the intent. I think that's really kind of where I would say the answer lies. Physically, he didn't kill him, right? But mentally, spiritually, he was committed to the act. Okay, and that was what God needed to see. Here's one possible explanation for that. Is it possible that Abraham's faith was divided between his son that he loved and the God that he served? Or, if it wasn't divided, was it possible that this was the test that God needed him to go through? Let's take a look. Go to the mountain and sacrifice. Came to pass after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, Here I am. And he said, Take now your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Notice the wording here. Your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. He's really putting it on thick there, isn't he? I mean, understand, I know who this is to you, Abraham. Go sacrifice him. It's a terrifying thought. God is testing him. It's about a 3 days journey. I don't know if he knew that before he started out or not, but it's about a 3 days journey. And then he's going to offer him as a burnt sacrifice. Is this normal for the worship of Jehovah? Of course not. No, it's not. In fact, Jehovah is, you know, God speaks in outrage of the worshipers of Molech who put their children through the fire, sacrificed their children to Molech. This is a terrible thing. So, did Abraham's faith waver in this? Wait around a week or so to see if God gave him a second prophetic word, maybe? You know, can we go to a different mountain? Maybe we'll get a different answer. He got up early the next morning. He got up, he went. Abraham obeyed. It's interesting that Genesis doesn't tell us what Abraham said in response. It doesn't tell us what his emotions were. It doesn't tell us how he reacted. It simply says that he went. Okay? Early the next morning, he prepared and went. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you." We will come back to you. Pleasant little white lie to keep them from worrying about him. Demonstration of faith. Not quite certain what's going on yet. But it's interesting. We will come back to you. And then we go a little bit further. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son. By the way, where else do we see the wood being taken and laid on the only son on his way to be sacrificed? As Jesus carried his own cross. And he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." An intimate conversation. Then he said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." Another prophetic word. But Abraham's been given instructions. What's going through his mind right now? Okay? This is a test. This is a trial on Abraham. They came to the place which God had told him. Abraham built an altar there, placed the wood in order, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." He said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or do anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. And Abraham called the name of the place, "The Lord will provide." As it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it shall be provided." Curiosity. Anybody know where this land of Moriah is? Anybody look that up? You know where it is. Yeah. If you go over to 1 Chronicles chapter 3, you find that Solomon built his temple on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. Interesting little synonym there, or symmetry, maybe. It's about 3 days' travel away from Beersheba, which is where they were. That's where Jerusalem is. So likely where this sacrifice took place was on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Of course, the temple wasn't there yet. So, did Abraham sacrifice his son? No, and yes, he did. Abraham demonstrated that he was willing to follow God's instructions, even if he didn't know what it was, even if he didn't know why, even if he didn't know how the promises were going to be fulfilled, after he kills the son that was the one who was going to be the source, you know, through whom all the promises went. This is the faith of Abraham. It's a really good reference. Let's look at Hebrews 11 for a minute, because there's a couple passages there. We start in verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. It says he offered him up. In his mind, in his heart, Isaac was dead. He was ready to do what God had said. Physically, God stopped him. But he had demonstrated that his love for God was above everything else in his life. When he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called," concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which also he received him, in a figurative sense. And then we see God reaffirming the blessings. So many parallels between this and what God did for us in Jesus. Yeah. And it's written for our instruction, you know, as we said. But this is the kind of faith of Abraham. He didn't have to know all of the answers. He just knew that God could accomplish his purpose. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time out of heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, says the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son." Notice the new terms here in the blessing. "Blessing I will bless you, and multiplying I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore. And your descendants shall possess the gate of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men. They rose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. So the blessings are reaffirmed, but now much more bountifully, much more magnified. Blessing I will bless you. Multiplying I will multiply you. The doubling of those verbs. So, some questions. Was God tempting Abraham? Keeping in mind James 1. You say no. Why not? Would Abraham have been wrong to complete the sacrifice? Yeah, because God told him to stop. Would he have been wrong not to go up on the mountain? Yeah, because God told him to go. Was God tempting him? Think. I'll read that passage to you. James 1:23. Reminds us, 1:13, sorry. "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am tempted by God,' for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone." So there must be another purpose. God is not trying to get Abraham to sin here. Testing and tempting are not the same word, are they? So what's the difference between those words, maybe? What does the testing of our faith do? Refines it, right? God, who knows the future as he knows today, was God waiting to see what was going to happen? Did he know what was going to happen, what Abraham was going to do? He already knew what Abraham was going to do. So the purpose of this test was not just for God to see what was going to happen. So who was it for? It had to be for Abraham in some way, right? So what was the purpose of this test for Abraham then? maybe to demonstrate his own faith to him, to make him see what faith requires, what faith means. And it's also for us. Everything that we see here is for our benefit somehow, and maybe for Abraham's benefit, but probably not for God's. God already knew what was going to happen in some way. That's an interesting thought. Think about Isaac laying there on that cold wood. That's a really good point. That's a really good point. And I'll make this point maybe in a slightly different way. If we want to set the right example for our husbands or wives or for our children, is the right example to show them how much we love them first? Or is the right example to show them how much we love God first? And as a result, we can better love and serve them. And Abraham definitely showed this to Isaac, didn't he? God came first. Here's an interesting question. How is Abraham's test different than Job's test? If you think about Job in the Old Testament. I don't know that this is all that significant. It's kind of one of those, gee, I wonder why. Job's testing originated with Satan. Okay, this testing of Abraham did not. This originated with God. Both for the same purpose, to test and to see how they're going to rise to that occasion and to show them their own faith. Yeah. Didn't know what was going to come. Yeah, so very, very different cases. But in both cases, they're being tested. Well, if the Bible in the Old Testament is going to talk about all these tests, what might we expect today? You know, maybe we're going to be tested as well. You know, and yeah. Yeah, it's important to recognize that God's thoughts are higher than our thoughts and His ways are higher than our ways. And we're not always going to understand why He does what He does. I'm pretty sure that Abraham didn't understand this. At least I hope he didn't. And we're not always going to understand either. But if we're fortunate, at a point in our life, we'll be able to look back and see some of those decisions that we didn't so much like at the time that actually were for our good, and that God was working something that was for our good or for His plan. Okay, thanks for your comments tonight. Next class on Sunday, we're going to start in Genesis chapter 23, and we'll finish up our discussions on Abraham.